There's a story that comes out of the Far East about an old master who had a fairly arrogant and disagreeable student. And one day when the young man was being a little bit more difficult than usual, he said, "There's a story about Buddha who one day sat down in front of a wall and at the end of the day rose up enlightened." And the student said, "Are you referring yourself to Buddha now?" And the teacher said, "No, the wall." There's a parable for you to think over. Okay, I'll make an application. The Psalms sometimes are going to be your wall. Okay, you look at them and you go, "Why are we studying this?" First of all, you got to ask yourself, well, there must be a reason that God put it there to begin with. Okay? Our problem is to look at that wall and figure out something, you know, from it. I don't know if you've ever done a study of walls or not. The walls are interesting if you stop to think about it. I mean, you can sit there and look how talented the guy was to put the plaster over it, or if there's no plaster, you know, how they fitted the bricks together or the stones or the earthwork or whatever. You might take the time to contemplate about the metaphors of walls, you know, why they're there, what their purposes are, whatever. There's also the reflexive part, you know, why we put kids in corners for a timeout. So, you know, give them some time to think about something. The Psalms cover all of these. Okay, it could be reflexive, it could just be the metaphors of what's going on, whatever. But you have to not just look over it or make yourself tired thinking about, "Oh man, another psalm tonight." One, I'm not going to go through every psalm that's there on these Sunday night, you know, lessons. After another couple of them, I'm going to hit just some highlights and intersperse it with maybe some of the shorter prophets, or eventually I want to get into a study of Ecclesiastes, which is more pertinent for our time. But for right now, give the Psalms a break. You know, we'll try to peel out of them, you know, probably a little bit more than you would get just glancing over them. There are reasons for them, and they not only edifying, but they're practical and useful. As we said before, it's David showing us, or God through David, showing us what we can ask for, what we can pray for, how confident we need to be when we come to God. It's something that helps us bridge the gap. You know, how to use our emotions properly, how to bring proper respect and reverence to God. Yeah, you get all this from David's Psalms and others, especially if you understand the background. So that's basically what we're going to try to do. So this evening we're looking at, no pun intended, an evening prayer psalm. As we went through last week, was a morning prayer by David. And so this one they've termed an evening prayer. So the other prayer was after you get up in the morning, what to pray. This one is, you know, how do you approach bedtime? What to get out of it. So we're going to be looking at the heading of this psalm suggests nothing that gave rise to its occasion. Like last time, obviously it was a psalm of David and the conflict, what he's having with his son Absalom. But there are significant elements between this psalm and Psalm 3, verses 2 through 3, that have the author in distress. There is, you know, his honor is being assailed. He seeks to correct his erring offspring and those with him. There's a courageous faith, you know, that's a prevailing element in this. And then throughout this psalm is a tone of wise and considerate restraint. It's very much like Psalms 3. So the supposition is it's covering basically the same background, because there's a lot of similarities. So if his enemies could be reasoned with, then this kind of reasoning in this psalm ought to be able to reach them. So this is something to consider too. You got enemies? Here's a little pattern, you know, perhaps to approach them. First, there's an urgent plea for help from God, how to set yourself up. Then there's a gentle reproach of the author's foes. Then there's an exhortation for them to reflect. Then finally, there's an expressed security in God addressed to those who have grown hopeless. So, beginning then, Psalms 4. There's only 8 short verses. So let's look a little bit deeper than just reading them over. Verse 1, answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. Thou hast relieved me in my distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. It starts off with men often speak this way when they are in trouble and it seems God's not listening to them. So there's kind of a hearkening to God. You know, answer me when I call. So evidently that's something we can get away with if we're in a right relationship with God. To gain some leverage, the psalmist, though, voices his conviction that his God is a righteous God. That's where his righteousness came from. He learned it from his God. And so God in his righteousness will look down upon him as he's, at odds with his enemies and will side with the individual that's righteous. The verb relieved here, when he talks about relieve me in my distress, can be translated set free, set at large. So this distress that's come upon the psalmist or David, he's looking out, God can free him up from this. He doesn't have to be depressed. He doesn't have to be confined in this life by the pressures that are upon him. God can, what does Paul say? With every temptation, God provides a way of escape. Then he asks for God to hear his prayer according to God's graciousness. And God is gracious. There's gifts that God gives freely. So he's willing to help out those, that not by any merit of their own, but just because that's what God does. Helps people that need help. Verse 2. O sons of men, how long will my... Now he's gone from God. Now he's addressing his enemies. How long will my honor become a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception? And that word selah. That is, stop, pause, think about what he's saying. Okay? As he addresses his enemies. The word for men implies brave men. That's the Hebrew implication of the word. But even though he uses it, it appears to be used in an ironic way. Almost a little bit of sarcasm. Oh, brave men, whatever. Why? Because their deeds are not brave deeds. They may be brave in other ways, but the way they're conducting their life, to undercut an enemy by, slander or whatever, it's not a fair or honorable way to approach things. Stand up to his face, if you got a charge against him, make the truth known. If not, that's not bravery to come up behind him and spread lies and everything else. They're trying to turn his honor into a reproach. The honor's legitimate, and they're trying to tear it down. That's not an honorable way to proceed. In fact, what he says, they love what is worthless. In fact, what they do is seek out industriously the fabrication of lies. Have you seen people do that? They spend a lot of their time just trying to tear other people down and don't try to really build up their own life. It's like they're out for revenge. Proverb, if you're going to start a life of revenge, first dig 2 graves, one for your enemy and one for yourself, because you just buried your own life. Verse 3, but know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. This is a consideration for his enemies. The Lord hears when I call him. What he's trying to tell them is that those who manifestly wrong a man are sinning against God. If he's a righteous man, he's an honorable man, then your sin is not just with him, it's with God in heaven. This is what David deeply felt. We've seen the example of his relationship with Saul. Even though Saul was going mad, he was hunting David down, trying to kill him. David still felt bad about even sneaking up on him and cutting off the fringe of his garment. Why? Because Saul was God's anointed, just as David now is God's anointed. And there's something special about that. There's something special about being God's people now. When people sin against those that are God's appointed, they also sin against God. And that's an appeal to enemies. You know, think about what you're doing. The godly are those whom the Lord has set apart in this world. Isn't that what sanctification is? As Christians, you've all been sanctified. You've been set apart, made different than the world, okay, in deserving special attention by God, nobody else. The conclusion from this is that the Lord will thus hear him. Okay? The other psalm we mentioned, yeah, does David have a past? Yeah. In fact, that's what Absalom's trying to use against him. You know, the murder of Uriah, the adultery with Bathsheba. Yeah. But this is the confidence that David has, okay? That he has a heart that God appreciates. When he's wrong, he admits it. He tries to do the right thing, and he knows God can forgive. So with confidence, even at this period of time in his life, after some really big problems and troubles and sins of his own, he can still go with confidence to God. Verse 4, tremble and do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. The word tremble implies that a wholesome, abject fear of God. That is, do you stand in awe before God? You know, we try to tell people that in this assembly, this is where God is. Do you come with a healthy respect? Do you come to what is considered a solemn assembly? Do you even tremble a little bit, you know, when you stop to think about it? I mean, this is what you have to reflect. This is not just a social gathering. You know, we are the temple of God. You know, we're his dwelling. This is where he abides when we assemble. We're before God now. Do you stand in awe of that? This is what he's trying to tell his enemies. Okay? Do you stand in awe before God? Thus they would be compelled to depart from all their wicked devices and abandon all their sin, for God's against them. I mean, when you're trembling before God and how powerful, how wise he is, what he can do, you know, you have to stop to think, if I'm doing the wrong thing, that's all being channeled against me. What I had Phil read, which also was what Will covered Wednesday night. The whole remark is, you know, if God's for you, who can stand against you? Well, the reverse is true. You know, do you want to be that the one that God is standing against? And this is what David is trying to get across, you know, to his foes. You know, you really want to live your life that way, and also face God in judgment because you've lived a life against him. As Paul put it, you know, just if you're going to be angry, make it a righteous anger. If you got something against David, let him know. Otherwise, you know, don't sin in that anger. Okay. His antagonists, and this is where it comes, you know, a prayer for them at night also, besides for David. His antagonists need to speak to their own hearts. That's that meditate. Okay. Sometimes the way we live life, we try to occupy our thoughts with things so that it's just filled with confusion. You may have music going all the time. You may watch television, video games, whatever. You may just like to be around people all the time. Have you ever taken the time to just sit down peacefully by yourself and have a long conversation with yourself? People that live alone develop that. You know, it's called companionship of the mind. Okay, it can get away from you, but it's something that you have to do. You have to speak to yourself. That's meditation. Okay? You have to start telling yourself, like your subconscious, what are your standards going to be? You know, what is your going to be your sense of right and wrong? What lines are you going to draw that you're not going to step over? Have you ever had that conversation with yourself? to look at yourself and say, this is going to be my personal integrity. Yeah. And also listening to the things, those little voices of what they're trying to tell you to do. Are they giving you good ideas or bad things? You know, bad ideas. It's all part of, you know, a dual nature that we have. That, you know, it has to be handled rightly or it can get away from us. And this is meditation. Talking to yourself in the proper language, in the proper terms. Encouraging yourself, you know, getting yourself enthusiastic. You know, saying there's just some things that you're not going to do. Sometimes people like to wallow in self-pity. You get to a point where you got to go, I'm not going to do this anymore. And you won't. You have to be stern with yourself. This is all part of the meditation of us talking with ourselves or listening what we're saying to ourselves. And this is what David's trying to get his opponents to. You know, look at what you're doing. You know, how petty have you become? How small? You know, what are you trying to accomplish? And when you stand before God in the final judgment, what are you going to have to offer Him? You know, and if you're going to have nothing, it's time to change. Okay? And let the stillness of the night be theirs. You know, some people just, you know, go through a life and even a night of confusion. You know, it's just, you know, it's like all snow up there. You know, well, this is what, you know, in meditation, especially in the still of the night, do you let the night take over? There's a reason that God gives us still nights, quiet nights, you know, to help affect our soul, to quiet us down. Okay, as you're laying there in meditation upon your bed, you know, what are your thoughts? Is your anger, frustration, whatever, calm down so that you can get a good night's sleep? Offer sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord. Their outward conduct should be made right. Okay, this is what he's encouraging them to do. The holiest of rites have been debased by their using it to cloak a world of maliciousness. We can see this in Absalom. We can, imply it from here. Well, if he's saying, why don't you offer sacrifices of righteousness, it's implied that their sacrifices have been wrong. One of the things that God complained about among Israel is their sacrifices were worthless. They were given impure animals. They were, you know, maybe offering an animal, but they weren't taking care of their lives. They weren't being righteous. They weren't helping out the widow or the orphan, you know, which would have been the true sacrifice. And sometimes they use these things as what should be a holy rite as a cloak for evil. You know, how much evil has been done in the world for the sake of religion or God or whatever. He's trying to get them to see through this. They need a substitute for their unholy acts, a sacrifice brought in a spirit without guile. Guile is doing something with ulterior motives. You know, it's a form of hypocrisy. You know, this is why Nathanael, you know, as he approached, you know, Jesus, he goes, a man without guile. A man who is pure, who did things out of pure motives. Only when men are thus motivated will their spirits dare to trust to the Lord. I mean, if you're working for yourself, if you're going for your own ambitions and stuff like that, you don't call on God for help. And you're going to start facing things in life that you cannot handle on your own. There are things in life that are just too big for an individual. But if you're living right, you can call on God for help. You can have Him in your corner. I mean, this is a consideration in life. You know, perhaps as young people, you know, we don't feel the brunt of that until we get older and out on our own. Or sometimes because we've knuckled under for so long, we really don't feel the power of the world. William Barclay, you know, made an illustration of during World War II, the people that gave into the Vichy government in France or basically were sympathetic with the Nazi Party, everything was fine. You know, they hardly even noticed World War II. It was only when you took a stand against what was considered evil that you felt the pure brute force and fury of the Blitzkrieg and the movement of the Nazis. So in this world, only when you start taking a stand against what is evil are you going to feel the full force of the world. And when you feel that, you know you're going to need God's help. You cannot take it on alone. Only then, if you've been living righteously, that you can trust in God. Many are saying, who will show us any good? The psalmist's words are now addressed to the disheartened among his followers. Those who keep reiterating things are never going to turn out right. These are the grumblers. These are the naysayers. These are the pessimists. Yeah, you know, aren't times going to change? It seems like the same old, it's all downhill, it's spiraling, whatever, it can't do any good. But unfortunately, he says there's many of these. That's what you're always going to find, many. What's the solution? Well, light up, you pray to God, who will show us any good? Now, light up the light of thy countenance upon us. Okay, now it shifts it back to God. David stands against this attitude with prayer. His allusion is to Numbers. And here in Numbers 6, verses 22 through 26. Short passage, but it's a prayer that Aaron was supposed to give for the sons of Israel. You know, those people that had a problem with grumbling. And then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and to his sons, saying, thus you shall bless the sons of Israel. You shall say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. So they shall invoke my name on the sons of Israel, and I will then bless them. So he pulls from this then, his own prayer. Okay? The lifting up of the light of thy countenance means to let the people bask in the radiance of his favor, to let his kindness be directed to them. It's an asking for God to make things better. That's all they had to do. They didn't have to sit and grumble. They just had to ask God, help them out. Give us some blessings. And then you got to sit there and appreciate them. Sometimes we overlook what God's already done for us. Thou hast put gladness in my heart more than their grain and new wine. The psalmist reflects upon the many other kind things that God has done to him in the past, where the Lord has let his experiences amount to the same kind of joy. But he says, God has always done this. That word hast there, past tense, he's always done this. It's also in a perfect tense expressing customary experience. Okay? David realizes one of the reasons why he's anointed, why he's blessed, why he's got confidence in God, because he realizes what God has been doing in his life, through the past. That he's always been there for him. That if you stop to reflect, as the song says, you count your blessings, you can't help but be optimistic and feel a bit better about life. The joy is put in contrast with the joy that his enemies have when they experience the highest joy they'll ever reach, of which they are capable. That is the joy from abundant food and drink. I mean, when people want to go out and have a good time, where do they go? Restaurant? Where they have the party, and they have the food, and they bring out the alcohol. That's as good as it gets in this world. And David says, okay, that's all they get. But the joy you have as a Christian, of being a child of God, far exceeds that. Even when you're in want. Okay? In fact, we talked about the ellipsis when we started these Psalms. Remind you, an ellipsis, grammatical construction, is actually a grammatical structure that's not complete. It's missing words. So it's not grammatically altogether. Yet we supply the missing parts. It's enough to get things done. We understand what's going on. So as this is put there, the words more are not there in the original, nor is the word abound. I mean, you could read it, than when there grain and new wine. That's literally what the Hebrew says. It's an ellipsis. But your mind automatically fills in more than their grain and wine in more than the gladness of what they have when the grain and wine, when they have it in and it abounds. Okay? You can get that out of it. And that's why the translators, put it that way. Went the wrong way. Okay. Now the historical background is the case when David and his men stood in need of provision. He thought he was blessed even though they're all, starving. In fact, this incident, 2 Samuel 16, 1 through 4, is when an old servant brings up a donkey full of, whatever their needs are. Food, a little wine in case somebody's depressed, whatever. Looking out for them. And then verse 8, in peace I will both lay down and sleep. Now he gets back down to, thanks of God. For thou alone, O Lord, doth make me to dwell in safety. The Hebrew often does not supply transitional words, but, it's come to a conclusion. And so you might put that in front of it. And so, after you said all that, in peace I lay down. Okay? Thus it follows that the assurance that David has gained shall allow him to be able to sleep calmly and unafraid. This is why this is considered a psalm or prayer of the evening. Something that David said, to get him through the night. So have a good night's sleep. His reason is that God alone can grant man such a sense of security. And when you've got these kind of turmoils in your life, God's the only one that can clear the mind and bring you rest. Or what does Paul call it? A peace that surpasses understanding. Okay, guarding your heart and mind. The psalm then comes to a close on a high level of faith. You see that from David. Okay? The mood has undergone a decided change from a cry of distress uttered in the first verse to a heroic, childlike confidence in his Creator. I mean, you can feel that, through the swing of this psalm. So, briefly, summary. First of all, he goes, answer me, God. Okay? The God of my righteousness, thou hast relieved me in the past of my distress. Be gracious now and hear my prayer. I don't merit it, but I can with confidence. As the Hebrew writer says, approach their throne of grace. O sons of men, looking at them, a brave man, irony, how long will you honor, will my honor become the thing that you try to tear down? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at trying to bring destruction? Think about it. How long are you going to do that? But now that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself, me included, David says, the Lord hears when I call him. Therefore, you should be trembling, because your sin is not just against me, it's against God. Think about this in your heart, to yourself, especially at night on your bed. When all is quiet, you can think about it deeply. Consider it. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness so that your sacrifice is acceptable to God, and then you can approach him and trust in the Lord. Of course, there are many that would be pessimistic about this. There's always those that are going to say, why aren't times better? Or we remember the old days, whatever. So to God, then, lift up thy countenance. Bless me, bless my people, as you promised you would, as we can call upon you to do. Thou hast put gladness in my heart. I've experienced a joy that no man in worldly pleasures has ever experienced. This is something that God promises. And therefore, in peace I lie down and sleep, for thou alone, O Lord, dost make me dwell in safety. Invitation. It's a psalm for us too. Okay, the nights still come to us as it did to them back then. It's a psalm for modern times. Perhaps we feel even more pressures than they did back then. Yeah, the nations are a lot stronger, more powerful. Man's greed outstrips, sometimes, he didn't think what he's done in the past. But we can still go to God. If we are his godly people, we can still call upon him. We can go to him at night and pray, and we can get a good, sound sleep, turning all our cares and problems over to him, knowing that he is working on them, and he can make a whole different day coming up. Changes. as long as we're children of God. And that's the invitation. You know, that's something for us to meditate on, to talk with ourselves about. Are we right with our Creator? Night's here. Close to time to find a quiet spot and talk to yourself and talk to your God. And if there's anything we can do, let us know. Let's stand to sing.